Today at Reader's Corner, Robert W. Mary, author of President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The turn of the 20th century was a momentous time in American history. After defeating Imperial Spain in a brief but consequential war, America had expanded its global reach with a footprint that stretched from Cuba and Guam to the Philippines. The country was developing and harnessing new technology like no other nation. Its economic and diplomatic power was soaring, and it had nudged Europe and Japan toward a collective policy with China that favored U.S. interest. While much has been written about these pivotal events, the man at the helm, President William McKinley, remained stubbornly in the shadows. Stolid, sweet-tempered, and deliberate, McKinley lacked the flair and boldness often associated with presidential greatness. Yet, as Robert Mary documents in his new book titled President McKinley, the nation's 25th president played a critical role in how and why the great events of the day unfolded as they did, and he deserves more credit than history has often given him. Mr. Mary spent nearly 45 years as a Washington, D.C. journalist and publishing executive, including a stint at the Wall Street Journal and as CEO of the Congressional Quarterly. He is also the author of the best-selling A Country of Vast Designs about James K. Polk, and he is currently serving as the editor of the American Conservative. Robert Mary was a guest on our show last year to talk about another of his books titled Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. He joins us by phone this President's Day weekend to talk about his latest work. Bob Mary, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very, very pleased.
Well, Bob, let's talk about your job as a presidential ranking specialist. There's a new title for you. But in any event, I'm really impressed with the fact that you've spent so much time ranking presidents, and I would urge our listeners to go back and listen to that previous show if they're interested, or grab the book for that matter. But when it comes to McKinley, he's not exactly one of our most celebrated presidents, and yet you call him the architect of the American century. Why don't we start with why? Why is this guy the architect of the American century?
Well, I have to say, I felt that it was a audacious subtitle. I was very proud to be that audacious because he doesn't, as you point out, he doesn't get that kind of attention or credit. And yet I really believe that I make the case that he was. Now, the man who gets the credit for taking America into the 20th century is Teddy Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, who is a marvelous, wonderful character in American history and a very consequential figure and a brilliant man. Often operating out of control, however, and T.R. never shared credit with anybody on anything. His own family, his own kids said that he desperately wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. He had to be at the center of attention. So when he became president, he basically denigrated his predecessor, the man who made him vice president. His biographers, over time, pretty much adopted the TR narrative that he was, in fact, the man who took America into the 20th century. But the foundation was laid by William McKinley. And I think that anybody who studies the McKinley presidency will come to that conclusion, as have the two really significant academic biographers of the last, 30 years or so. The last major book on McKinley was written in 1959, so it's been a long drought for this man. And historians in the polls that I look at from time to time don't rank him near the bottom at all. In fact, probably in the upper reaches of the middle. But the American people have no conception of this man and what he accomplished.
To the point of Teddy Roosevelt stealing a little bit of McKinley's thunder, I'm reminded of the speech I believe Roosevelt gave upon assuming the presidency, which was, of course, because of McKinley's assassination. He was serving as vice president. I wonder if you could, if not quote, at least share with us the way Roosevelt decides. I mean, McKinley wasn't dead but a few days or whatever, and he's already pointing out that this new administration is going to be a lot different.
Well, it's really interesting because initially, when he first took the oath, he announced that he was going to carry on the McKinley legacy and he was going to carry on the McKinley policies. But that's what you normally do when you become vice president in such circumstances. There's evidence he said that in part because he was concerned about a stock market swoon. But within days, as soon as he got back to Washington, he called a bunch of reporters into his office and he said, "I'm going to govern just as if it was myself elected by the electors and not William McKinley." So he essentially said, "I'm the president and I'm president constitutionally, and therefore I'm not going to even consider my predecessor." And there are some significant policy initiatives that he just essentially abandoned, including some that would have been very positive. McKinley was working towards a kind of a synthesis on trade policy. He was a great protectionist all of his career, but he was beginning to realize that America had such a productive capacity that it simply had to have overseas markets if it was going to continue to grow. And so he was looking for a kind of a middle ground, a kind of hybrid idea of what he called reciprocity. We hear that term today, actually, in trade matters, in which barriers would come down if they were done mutually. Well, TR just basically abandoned that and went back to old-fashioned Republican protectionism.
So let's talk about McKinley as a decision maker. And I think you call him the master of incrementalism. And you spend quite a bit of time, directly or indirectly, talking, I guess, about what you could call presidential temperament. It's an interesting subject today that we'll get to in a minute. But for now, help us with McKinley as a president and this temperament issue.
McKinley was, you mentioned that he operated from the shadows, and I make that point in the book. He operated in the shadows as a man in his dealings with people. People didn't know what he was really thinking. He was always very pleasant. He was just a great guy. People didn't know what he was thinking. They didn't quite know what he wanted. He just kept that obscure. And he knew that some people kind of thought that he wasn't much of a figure. It wasn't a man of mark. But that didn't bother him because he had a way of manipulating people when they didn't even know they were being manipulated into moving in the direction that he wanted them to move. And until you understand that about McKinley, you simply can't understand his presidency. But he was a master at it. And those who knew him well understood this aspect of him and respected it a great deal. It was said that he always got his way. And his war secretary, Lothar Root, said that one of the reasons for that is because he never cared who got the credit. As long as he got what he wanted, he didn't care who sort of stood up and said, I did this. And as a result of that, he managed to really move events in the direction he wanted them to go. Now, I will say this. He was not a man of vision. T.R. was a man of vision. He had a vision of American greatness. Henry Cabot Lodge, the Massachusetts senator and T.R.'s great friend, he had a vision of the same thing. And Alfred Thayer Mahon, the naval strategist, they all had that vision of American greatness. McKinley didn't come into the presidency with that kind of a vision or that kind of imagination even. But once events began to unfold, he had a knack for understanding not only where they were going, but how they could be deflected in the chosen direction. And that's what he did. So I'll make one other point here about this. He was viewed as a very decent human being, but he was an iron-willed man. And one of my favorite anecdotes from the book is from a congressman who was friendly with McKinley, but was a little wary of him for the reasons that will become clear. And he was quoted talking to a newspaper man once about McKinley, and he said, "Why, if McKinley and I were walking through an orchard that had but one bearing tree, and that tree but two apples, McKinley would walk under that tree, he'd pick the two apples, he'd put one in his pocket, he'd take a bite out of the other one, and then he would turn to me and say, 'Ben,'" this is Ben Butterworth, "'Ben, do you like apples?'" What Butterworth was trying to say is that, yeah, he's a very pleasant guy, you know, he saunters through the orchard talking, you know, but he just basically takes all the apples.
Right.
And if you understand the man, you understand that he got a lot of apples over the course of his career.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Robert Mary, author of President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Well, the earlier part of your description of McKinley seems to be in decided contrast to our current president, and especially the tweeter-in-chief aspect of that presidency. And I think that becomes pretty clear as I'm reading your book anyway. But I'd ask you to look through the rest of the 20th century and into current times. What president strikes you as more like McKinley when it comes to this kind of plotting decision-making process that takes all things into account, slows the decision-making process down, trying to reach the right decision? I mean, the way I think about a McKinley, I think of a Dwight Eisenhower, for example, for some reason. But
oh, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that they're the parallels between Eisenhower and McKinley are very, very strong. I think temperamentally they were very similar. Neither one was a man of vision. Each one, however, was a man of decisiveness who knew how to make decisions and did it methodically, didn't care who took the credit. I mean, Eisenhower was famously described as having had a, quote, hidden hand presidency. And I think that's the kind of presidency that McKinley had. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. Probably Taft. William Howard Taft would be somewhat like that. In our time, in the era of television, I think that's not the kind of temperament that we normally go to and gravitate to for our president. So aside from Eisenhower or since Eisenhower, I can't think of anybody very much like that.
And I guess one of the points you make in the book, and maybe you can explain this to our listeners, is that times are so different and the role of the media is so different, even social media. But take social media out of it for a minute. The fact is, everything from McKinley's front porch strategy to a lot of other things, and you might want to tell us about that, that just simply doesn't work in the 21st century, I suppose you would argue.
I think that's probably true. I think that you have to be a little bit more visible. You have to be, you have to use that bully pulpit electronically in a way that you didn't absolutely have to. Certainly it worked for Teddy Roosevelt, and he used it brilliantly. But I think today you have to use the bully pulpit, and I think it has to, you do it electronically. You do it on television. Now you do it on social media. But when McKinley ran for president, as you point out, the front porch strategy, very, very interesting. He's running against William Jennings Bryan, and Bryan was all over the country on trains and giving speeches from 6 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. And McKinley just wasn't going to compete with that. So he said, I'm just going to stay in my house and invite the American people to come to me. 750,000 Americans in 1896 came to his house. They totally destroyed his yard and his garden, but he didn't care. And they came from all over the country in delegations and groups. And he managed to connect with the American people that way. And, of course, it was all covered by contingent of reporters who covered all of the exchanges, so he was able to get his message out and control the message very effectively.
Well, you mentioned Eisenhower, and it brings to mind the fact that both McKinley and Eisenhower had military backgrounds. Admittedly, Eisenhower went up the totem pole a bit higher than McKinley did, but I didn't really, to be honest about it, understand much about McKinley's early years and his service in the Civil War. Take us through that experience, and then if you would also something about his personal life, his wife Ida Saxon.
Well, he was a military hero, really. I think it would be impossible to deny that. He entered the Army at the beginning of the Civil War as an 18-year-old private. He quickly was promoted because of his organizational skills, perceived by his commanding officer, Rutherford B. Hayes, later President of the United States and his great mentor, perceived as a young man who had organizational skills far beyond his years. So he became a sergeant. He became a quartermaster sergeant. His job was to make sure that provisions got to the troops. Well, Battle of Antietam, he was a couple of miles behind the lines because he was organizing provisions and the delivery of provisions to troops. He heard about a unit that was pinned down. This was late afternoon. The battle had began at Antietam, the bloodiest single day of combat in our national history. Had begun very early in the morning. They had had no breakfast. They had had no lunch, and they had long since run out of water. So McKinley got into his head he was going to get provisions. He was going to get victuals to these beleaguered troops who were basically going to get slaughtered if they couldn't do battle. So he loaded up a wagon. He found a volunteer, and he started headed out to get to these troops that were pinned down. And twice he encountered superior officers who told him to get back. You no way you could possibly do this. But as they moved on to the battle, he continued along his journey through the woods until he came to the clearing where the battle was going, and he ran right through it, right through the lines, and managed to get those provisions to those troops. Well, that got him a commission, and he ended the war as a brevet major, 22-year-old brevet major. It's a pretty impressive record, even by Civil War standards. And he had several other episodes like that where he didn't seem to know the use of fear, as Kipling put it in Gunga Din. He just put himself in harm's way in the interest of the battle and somehow managed to pull it off and survive in each instance.
I'm curious, did the average American in those days, the journalist perhaps, know those things about McKinley the way we know that John McCain was a prisoner of war and was a jet fighter in Vietnam?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Those are the things that were very important to Americans at that time. And there's a famous quote when someone, after McKinley had been elected president, but before he took over, someone asked him, he was referred to as the major often, uh-huh. and people would address him as major. But, of course, he was known as, you know, now Mr. President, and he was known as governor, and he was known as congressman. So they said, how would you like to be addressed? He said, call me Major. I've earned that. I'm not sure about the rest.
That's great. So let's talk about his wife, Ida Saxon. I wonder if you could help us understand this, what might just be a very unique and devoted relationship in American presidencies.
Well, it's a very poignant story. In fact, in some ways, I view it as almost kind of a tragic story in some ways. But nevertheless, it is a very human tale. Ida Saxon was the belle of Canton, Ohio. Her father was the richest man in Ohio. He owned a newspaper. His father had brought a printing press out by Oxon to begin journalism in that out-of-the-way place, and her father had then built upon that business success by going into banking and mining and development and many, many other things. And she was lovely and sprightly and clever, a cute little thing, petite, and she had lots and lots of suitors, and she enjoyed all of that. Well, she ended up sort of selecting this stolid young man who seemed to be on his way politically. And it looked like a storybook romance and marriage until a series of things happened that really brought Ida down. They had a child, a daughter, after about a year, and named her Katie. And then sometime later she was pregnant again, and then things began to really turn south. She learned during the pregnancy that her mother was dying, probably of cancer. It's not clear that that made her pregnancy a troubled pregnancy, but it was. That daughter, named after her, Ida, was born and died within 4 months. And she was inconsolable. And she went into a swoon of depression. And then at age 4, her other daughter, the last daughter, was died of cholera. In the meantime, she had some kind of an accident. It was described as a carriage accident, but the details are unclear. I'm gathering that she maybe fell backwards and harmed her spine because she was somewhat immobile for much of her life after that. She was in wheelchairs sometimes, had to carry a cane. And on top of all of this, she also developed, maybe related and maybe not, we don't know, epilepsy. So she would have these occasional fits. So all of that turned her into a totally different person from that sprightly, clever, fun, loving young woman. She became kind of sedentary and a little bit self-absorbed and occasionally somewhat peevish, very demanding in terms of what she wanted from her husband, whom she loved dearly. And the wonderful thing about this story is that his devotion to her never wavered, not even a tiny bit, in the course of his life as he grappled, I assume, with this total transformation of the woman that he had married. And he was always there for her whenever she needed it, notwithstanding all of the heavy burdens that he carried in his political life.
Well, the most poignant moments were when he'd be in really important meetings as president of the United States, and someone would open the door and say, "Your wife needs you," and he'd suspend the meeting and take care of Ida and then get back to the meeting. I mean, it was quite impressive. This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking with Robert Mary about his new book, President McKinley, which explores the life and legacy of the nation's 25th president. So help us understand what America's place in the world looked like in 1896 when William McKinley assumes the presidency. It doesn't seem as though he goes into his presidency thinking he's going to be a war president, but maybe we can start with the Spanish-American War and how that unfolds. But this is a guy who, as you say, becomes the architect of the American century largely due to the way he changes America's role in this world.
He turned America into an empire. It had not been an empire. I think it's important to remember also that when he was elected, we were still in the throes of the Panic of 1893, which was probably the country's worst depression until the Great Depression. And that spurred a lot of the dissent and the populism and the anti-gold, free silver coinage sentiment that was so powerful in the West and the South and the rural areas of America at that time. But the amazing thing about that, from my perspective as I studied it, was how America was struggling with that depression, but nevertheless, the optimism of America never really wavered particularly. It was always understood that America was on the move, and it was an expansive nation. So when we ended up in these situations of tension, serious tension with Spain as a result of the insurrection in Cuba that was destabilizing the Caribbean right in our backyard, and of course you have to throw in America's intrinsic humanitarian impulses, it became inevitable that America and Spain were going to go to war. And when that happened, we just sort of burst out into the world, because we destroyed two Spanish fleets, one in the Pacific at Manila Bay and the other one at Santiago, Cuba. We essentially kicked Spain out of Cuba. We picked up Puerto Rico in the bargain. We got Guam in the very tough peace negotiations that McKinley brought about. And we picked up the Philippines. In the meantime, we had already picked up Hawaii, which was one of the two or three most strategic points on the entire globe. And we were moving towards, and it was really McKinley who made this possible, we were moving towards the construction of what became the Panama Canal. So America was on the move, and we were building a navy, a global navy. But it was McKinley who sort of pulled all this together into making America an imperial power. I will say that he crafted a concept, and I think it ultimately became Franklin Roosevelt's concept, of a powerful global nation like America that didn't attempt to ply the global waters strictly through acquiring colonies. In fact, he wasn't totally comfortable just going about, as Germany was doing at that time, just finding colonies wherever you could. In fact, he pretty much saved China with the open door policy from being carved up and destroyed as a nation by the industrial powers of Europe and Japan.
So tell us a little bit more about Hawaii. I mean, I don't know whether a lot of our listeners appreciate the role that McKinley played in our relatively new state compared to many of the others.
Well, Hawaii is a fascinating story, and it's kind of a sad matter that Americans don't know that story very well, because it's a story that it's not totally bringing credit upon our country and some people within our country, but nevertheless, it's also a reflection of the expansionist spirit. Hawaii was a crucial place out there in the Pacific. From Hawaii, you can pretty much dominate the Pacific. If you don't have Hawaii, then whoever has Hawaii is going to dominate it. And so when McKinley realized that Japan was really hovering and that we needed to either let them have it, or we needed to move very, very quickly to annex Hawaii, because the the Caucasians of American background. Many had been there for generations in the running sugar plantations, but nevertheless, they were not of the indigenous Polynesian peoples of Hawaii. And they had essentially taken over the government, and they wanted to be annexed to America. And so as soon as he saw that there was a prospect that Japan could end up with the islands, he moved very quickly with dispatch on the annexation treaty and managed to get it through Congress. He couldn't get it through the Senate, which required a two-thirds vote as to ratify the treaty. So he did it the way we acquired Texas, not through treaty, but through an annexation legislation that had to go through both houses, but didn't need a two-thirds majority.
You know, when you talk about military advantage in the Pacific, Guam's another great example. We've had many military encounters there, and we're still there.
Yes, indeed. Guam has been a significant part of our presence in the Pacific since the beginning. That came out of the blue. When the negotiations began, Spain asked the French ambassador to Washington to represent Spain's interests in those negotiations. And a guy by the name of Cambon came to the White House and said, Mr. President, you can't get any more glory, so I'm sure that you'll want to be very magnanimous in your peace negotiations. And McKinley didn't say anything, but he was not. He was anything but. And he essentially said, I won't even begin discussions unless Spain agrees to leave Cuba and give us Puerto Rico and an island in the Pacific. And that ended up being Guam.
Well, Bob, as you look back on this book, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, there's so many lessons of history to take away from this. William McKinley was a Republican president, very successful in his day. Is there a message in your book about or for the Republican Party, about presidents, when it comes to rankings and ratings and reappraisals of McKinley? Your book certainly will play a role in elevating him, I hope. What's the takeaway here?
You know what? That's a fascinating question, and there is something that's been sort of eating at me a little bit. When I think about American foreign policy under the McKinley era, and TR for that matter as well, and think about it today, and maybe compare, just sort of throw in China, what occurs to me about American foreign policy is how focused it was. It was focused on, you know, America's position in the world, and we didn't get wrapped up in extraneous questions about how any country is governing itself, for example. In that sense, we were extremely successful. The creation of the Panama Canal, that sort of reminds me of what China is doing with this One Road, One Belt foreign policy initiative. And today, America is so worried about the humanitarian necessity of making sure that nobody is being abused in this country, and going after Iran, and trying to remake the Middle East, and worrying about every bilateral relationship in these sometimes fiery regions of the world. And we get really sort of waylaid. China's not waylaid. They know exactly what they're doing. And it sort of reminds me that China's more like America was back in the 1890s, at the turn of the century, the last century, than we are now. So if I were to try to answer that question, I think that would be the answer, that it's a sort of the focus of foreign policy and how it relates to national self-interest.
That is a fitting conclusion to your book and to our conversation, Bob. I want to once again remind our listeners that we've been listening to Bob Mary. Robert Mary is the author of President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Bob, thanks again for being with us on Reader's Corner.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Next week, veteran U.S. diplomat Matthew Palmer, author of the political thriller Enemy of the Good. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you've missed some of our previous interviews, you'll find them on our free app for mobile devices. Download it from Google Play or the App Store to listen anytime.